I'm Sam Clements, and welcome to the latest edition of the Picture House podcast. Today, I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleagues, Karina Antrobus.
Hi.
And Sarah Cook.
Hello.
Karina Antrobus, comms manager for Picture House Cinemas, and Sarah Cook, marketing manager for Picture House Central. Welcome. How have you been, guys? It's actually been a while since we've all been in the same room together because, well, I mean, summers. We've been on a summer holidays. But in that time, Sarah, you've interviewed a whole bunch of people. Will Poulter from Midsummer. I was lucky enough to interview directors of Toy Story 4. Karina, who have you interviewed?
No one. I feel really left out. What have you all been doing? You've all been having all this fun without me. I've been probably burrowing away in the office, hard at work.
Oh, you were doing that.
Yeah, that thing.
Well, thank you.
No worries, you're welcome.
Holding the fort down.
Yeah.
So I thought this would be a good time maybe to talk about some of the things that we have seen recently that are still playing at Picture House Cinemas and maybe to look ahead and see what exciting things are coming up. Sound good?
Great.
Awesome. Toy Story 4 has been out the longest and it's still doing incredibly well in cinemas. Have you all seen this film?
Yes.
And I guess when I first saw there was a Toy Story 4 on the release calendar, I was a bit like, I mean, I love Pixar, but do we need another one of these? Is that, how did you guys feel?
I just thought you would be absolutely thrilled rather than worried. But then I do see the worry because 4 is a bit excessive, isn't it?
Well, and also, I think for those who've followed the series, it's sort of often referred to by nerds as a perfect trilogy. In my eyes, it's one of the great trilogies. You know, it's The Godfather and Toy Story 3.
Yeah, it's nicely rounded at 3, isn't it? But 4 does. I mean, when was the first one? When did the first one come out? What year
95.
Was that? 95. That is so long ago.
Yeah.
I'd like to say I wasn't even born, but I was so born.
God, I was 8 years old and my mind was blown. Like, seeing computer graphics, 3D animation, and me asking my dad, how do they do this? How do they do this? Because I couldn't work it out.
It's always been so slick. And I think that was one of the first films that really showed off the excellence of Pixar for me. And I was still too young to really appreciate the cinematic marvelry of it. But I remember being amazing. And magic, yeah, yep. Absolutely that. I must admit, I can't really remember how 3 was for me. Number 1 was obviously great.
Distressing. Yeah. 3 is emotional.
I remember going with my older sister to 3, and obviously we'd grown up together watching the Toy Stories, and the finality of it was so apparent throughout. And we were clutching each other, crying and sobbing, and it was just such a well-rounded film for them to be like, and then there's a 4, just seemed very tacky. It just, because they just finished the saga so well. The trilogy was, the final moments of Woody saying goodbye to Andy was so, so you don't need any more than that. And then you still don't need any more than that after Toy Story 4, I think.
No.
So you think Toy Story 4 is now the perfect end?
Nope.
You do not. So Toy Story 3 is the perfect end for you and Toy Story 4. Now, I disagree with you because, say, this is how my review goes. Very sceptical, a little bit worried because I think it's a perfect trilogy. Mm. And you know what? Pixar pulled out the bag. I've seen Toy Story 4 3 times now.
I went to Paris
to see this movie. I really, really like it. Mm. I think it's, for me, it's an epilogue. I think there's the meat of the story is 1, 2, and 3. I think this is a really great epilogue and an absolutely cracking film. Really fun. Still a little bit sad. Not as sad as Toy Story 3.
But I think it's
justified its existence.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, actually. And I think I would now welcome a 5th and a 6th. Because I do.
Whoa.
Yeah, I would. I genuinely would. Because I feel like there's a whole new culture within this 4th one that it's addressing. There's a lot more female empowerment. There's a lot more room for these new characters, and there's an evolution in the narrative which I think has still got some time to go with some further films down the line. So yeah, I was surprised too. I enjoyed it a lot.
I'm going to say something controversial and say it's the Kingdom of the Lost Skull type movie for me.
Oh, wash your mouth.
As in,
jump the shark.
I think for me it was strong. But what frustrated me the most is the reason I finally got excited for Toy Story 4 was it was going to answer the existential crisis of toys and why they're alive with Forky.
Yeah.
And then they ditched him. They ditched his narrative so quickly. And then I just became very bored and very fed up with following Woody going through these crises that he always does. And it just became very predictable with Gabby Gabby and any arc in this. I just knew where it was going.
I will give you that. Because I think there was room for them to really push the boat out with some extra non-predictable dialogue or predictable narratives. And I think I won't spoil it, but the very last section, I thought it was going to be something quite groundbreaking, but actually it rosied itself off with something quite safe. I was like, oh, okay.
It has good moments. I mean, Duke Kaboom.
New character voiced by
Keanu Reeves.
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't know that was Keanu Reeves until afterwards. I was like, oh, it's Keanu Reeves.
Hysterical. And the ongoing Combat Carl joke is probably one of my funniest bits in cinema. And you have to stay behind the credits.
That was a really fun thing to do.
I've never cheered so loudly because just before that happened, me and my sister were like bemoaning about the life of this Combat Carl. And it just got its nice satisfactory conclusion. I was very bored. And the more I was like actually laid in bed, couldn't sleep because I was thinking about how they did Forky wrong.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, actually, to myself, to the air, going, this is so wrong. And bit by bit, the more I think about it, the more I'm frustrated with how lacking this film was.
But I thought Forky was actually way better than I was expecting. Because as soon as, do you remember when the first photos came out of what Forky was going to be and looked like,
everyone
was outraged. Everyone was like, what the hell is this?
But that was when I was sold. So when I saw Forky, I was like, this is genius. I was like, this is a genius idea to get someone that's not conventionally a toy and explore what it is to be a toy. Mm.
Well, I thought it was going to be a whole conversation about climate change and how we need to stop using plastic forks. But, you know, drop the ball there.
I could have done a wooden spork.
I know. Maybe that will be number five.
Well, no one tries to recycle Forky. He wants to go into trash. That's his mission. He is trash.
But there's the thing. And then there's this bit where he's struggling. And then they have a conversation and he's no longer struggling. And I really struggled. I struggled with that. That made me struggle. And I was like, no, but it needs to be about Forky. Mm-hmm. And then Woody needed to come in and have his kind of moment.
I think they use Forky to because I think it's Woody's film. The pitch is, we've had Andy's story, the original boy from the film, who looks like a zombie in Toy Story 1. And he's got better animated as the films have gone on. But I think it's Woody's story. It's Woody learning to sort of let go of his own, you know, to grow as a person and to leave, you know, a previous occupation or life behind, whatever the sort of metaphor is there. And he does that through Forky, who sort of displaces him as the, makes it, you know, the new favourite toy.
Mm.
And sort
love.
Of Woody seeing that.
It's always love. He finds love.
Enjoyed that if Toy Story 2 hadn't have explored Woody's grapple and Toy Story 3 hadn't have dealt with Woody's grapple. And I would have enjoyed that more. But it's Toy Story 4 dealing with Woody's grapple, but obviously with a different...
I loved Bo. I thought Bo was so much more interesting this time. And even just in from the get-go, it was when Woody was like, oh, I didn't know they had names. He was like, she was like, you didn't ask. And just that framed it so well for me. I was like, okay, yeah, I get what they're doing here and it's actually being done quite well. They're giving the woman a voice. She's actually got a character and she was badass.
Mm. It's such a nice evolution for her because in Toy Story 1, she's only in like two scenes. Yeah. And actually, talking about representation, there are no other female characters in Toy Story 1 at all. So it's sort of like now there's a whole bunch of them, but also it's sort of Bo has a significant amount of screen time.
Mm.
But then I got frustrated that they ditched Jessie and Buzz really easily.
Yeah, like, yeah, none Buzz, of the other toys get a look in
really. Well, Buzz gets his little moment, but Jessie doesn't. And Jessie is so integral. Well, in Toy Story 2, she got introduced as pretty integral, and then they bit by bit have like sluiced her back, apart from one brilliant short, Toy Story short, which was amazing. I just feel like the Toy Story shorts could have carried on for the like rest of my life, and I'd be happy. But and the feature length film just wasn't.
Well, the Toy Story shorts may well do. That'd be quite nice, actually, just have little capsules with individual characters to see. And you know, there's a new Disney streaming service coming. It might be a great home for them. That's why apparently we didn't get a Pixar short. Before Toy Story, Pixar are going to send their short straight to the Disney streaming platform.
That is outrageous.
Not to cinemas.
Outrageous. Mm.
I think it's such a tradition getting there to see the Pixar shorts. And those Pixar shorts win Oscars and they're very celebrated.
Exactly.
So it's a shame that we don't get to see them.
Yeah. How amazing was it for someone who just cut their teeth on the short than to show it in front of a
big... which is the director of Toy Story 4, Josh Cooley. He directed, he co-wrote Inside Out, which is an amazing film. And he then directed and wrote a short about Inside Out, which is on the Inside Out Blu-ray. And then he went from doing a short of Inside Out to Toy Story 4, which is huge. He's like handed the keys to Pixar in the headline franchise of that studio. So interesting. Okay, a mixed bag in the room. I personally really liked it. I can highly recommend free viewings, Sarah, if you can stomach it.
Give it another go. But, maybe you'll sleep better.
Solely so I can take my 6-year-old niece. And I get that there is that element of it's not really for me. It's kind of for the kids who want their new story in their own little generation. That's nice, but
it's totally no. So it's for Sam.
Yeah, I was going to say it's definitely for big kids too.
And Sam Clements.
interesting, but I love that we're having this talk about it, and it's still in cinemas, so people can go see the film for themselves and see if they're hashtag Team Sarah, hashtag Team Sam.
Oh my god, these are some of those hashtags. It'll make me cry.
And I feel like the natural sort of forward progression from Toy Story 4 is probably to Midsommar.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
The new horror movie from Ari Aster, who last summer had Hereditary, the horrific Toni Collette horror movie.
I
haven't actually seen Midsommar yet, but like Toy Story 4, I think it has been dividing audiences, and there are lovers and there are haters.
I love the automatic West Country accent that people just keep adopting when they say Midsommar. It's Midsommar, guys. It's Midsommar.
It's spelled with an A, though.
I know. No, you're being way more fun than I am. I'm being a bit of a stick.
So, I mean, what is Midsommar, and what did you both think?
I really enjoyed it, and I had zero expectation, but I'm a real wuss when it comes to horror films. I'm not very good at them at all. I've got an overreactive imagination, so things do tend to freak me out. And I also don't really like being in the space of a cinema where you're so arrested by all your emotions and being flung in front of something that is really distressing. It's not really my idea of entertainment. But Ari Aster, big fan. He came in for Sundance London last year and looked after him through working at work, and I promised I'd go and see it. And Hereditary was an incredible piece of work in the way that it was playing with fear and the expose of looking at grief. Toni Collette was fantastic. And then there was something about Midsommar, and even before I saw it and the marketing started coming out for it, I remember having a dream about the trailer. And I hadn't even seen the trailer.
Wow.
So there was something seeping into my conscience about this imagery and how it was going to make me feel. Anyway, I went to go and see it and I loved it. And I learnt a lot about the whole Midsommar regime. It's not regime, it's a what is it?
Celebration?
That's how much I learned about it. I can't even... Yeah, it's a festival.
Yeah.
And it's the first 10 minutes... are so distressing. It's unreal. So if you're late, don't go, because you will just not really fully appreciate how distressing this film is. But those first 10 minutes are incredible, and I won't say any more. But after a tragic incident, it's about a group of students who then go to Sweden for an escape and an exploration into the Midsommar festivities, because there's a guy who's doing his PhD on such things. But also about Florence Pugh, who has had this awful incident happen to her, and so she goes and she ends up essentially tacking on to this lad's weekend or week away, much to the disgruntlement of the lads, who are just there thinking that they're going to, and they say this, going to impregnate loads of Swedish girls, which is like, okay, that's problematic, but that's the point. And then awful things happen
right.
for the next 2 hours. It's relentless. But what's so interesting about it is that it's so opposite from what you're normally expecting of a horror film. It's bright, it's so fluorescently lit. There's so much happiness and joy to the point where it's just creepy.
Yeah.
There's a lot in it. There's a lot in it. There's so much to say about whiteness and ritual and tourism and religion and grief, which is becoming a characteristic of Ari Aster's tendencies. And he does it so well and so distressingly. But
apparently,
also, what was... Yeah,
just it's, on it's, grief, apparently this is part of a grief trilogy. So we're going to have another distressing Ari Aster.
I mean, he's doing it very well. He's, why give up? But what distresses me more is the reality of it, is that he actually made it as a breakup movie. So he wanted to make this movie to help mine or articulate the grieving process of what happens when you break up with someone. And my God, if you break up with somebody and they make Midsommar, then I don't know whether that's a compliment or something that you really need to think about how you break up with your next person, because God damn it, that's going to be that's a scary movie for somebody to make after they've spent however long with you. Yeah. So, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Sarah, I know you got to see this film at 11 o'clock in the morning. And how was that experience?
So last year I watched Predatory at like 8 o'clock in the evening, and after that experience I phoned my housemate. I was like, "You're in, right?" I was like, "If you're not in, can you make yourself home? Can you turn all the lights on?" And I kept my lights on for a week.
You should just turn them off. It's too bright.
It's for Hereditary, right? So at Midsommar, I went to see it at 11 o'clock in the morning and left the screening room after 2.5 hours in this blistering sun, and I was like, I'm not okay. Like, I need to go and find a shadowy room and sit there in a dark room and never trust sunlight ever again. It took me a while, because you have to process it. It's a process. Yes. Like, when the tree's an onslaught, but Midsommar, it seeps in. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I just think it's phenomenal. And I haven't stopped thinking about it since. Every day I'm thinking about different scenes and different layers of what it means. Because, like you said, there's a commentary on white tourism. Yeah. There's a commentary on sexuality. There's a commentary on...
bros, I think, bros, as well. Like, being
awful
bros.
Boyfriends.
Yeah.
There's a commentary on intellectualism. There's a commentary on taking... like, white person taking, like... his black friend's piece. There's just so much to say that I really want to go watch it repeatedly, even though some of the imagery is so shocking and
there's
so horrific.
There's some things I can't unsee, but it's also really, really funny.
It's really hilarious.
It's really funny. At one point, I just turned to who I was sitting with and I was like, WTF. Is that happening?
So hilarious. You got like four guys who are pretty much dickheads.
Yeah.
And then they're like... thrown into this obscure land, and they're so hilarious because it's like Jack Rayner, William Harper, and Will Poulter.
Great.
I can't remember the guy who plays Pele, because obviously Pele's the freaky one. He's more intellectual and a bit more weird than the main three. But they're hilarious. They're kind of like bouncing. There's a scene at the beginning where Jack Rayner's character comes in and confesses something to them, and their faces are genius. And I've never laughed so hard in a cinema this year.
They're a bit like the boys from Inbetweeners.
They
are just like that, and just as bad, but just a little hotter.
Well, I'm wondering what you're saying about this film. Obviously, horrific, and Ari Aster is a master of horror. But could Ari Aster just do a straight up comedy?
I think Ari Aster could do a really good musical.
Yeah.
It'd be horrific. It'd be like a horror musical.
Yeah.
And traumatic. But I genuinely think he could do a really good one.
I think he could do a comedy for sure.
I mean, like Dancer in the Dark esque style. Like Lars von Trier did a musical.
Yeah.
And it was horrific and terrible.
Yeah.
It was amazing, not terrible, but like terrible to
terrible
watch.
Terrible things happened.
Terrible things happened to like Bjork and.
But he's got a real. I think he's got a real grasp on how to make people feel deeply uncomfortable and haunted, and latches on to quite unique... there's a lot of detail. Mm-hmm. And that's where the comedy is. The comedy is in the detail of the facial expressions and the beats and just those little moments that are too long or just the right amount. And that's where the comedy is. And I think if he played on that... he could do something really, really funny.
Absolutely. He's weirdly for me, like there's a lot. I mean, obviously there's, you can imagine what horrific things that you see in this. The one that disturbed
I don't know
me,
if you can though. I honestly don't know.
I'm just thinking about Toy Story 4. So, yeah.
There's a scene that literally when it first happened, my stomach went, oh, I don't like this. And it's just because Will Porter's head is disproportionate in this tiny car.
Because
it's like a dream sequence.
It's trippy as well.
And it's trippy. And I sat there, and this is why I'm saying, because like her issue is so, like it's the proper horror. It's like... in your face, whereas Midsommar just seeps in and your stomach goes, oh, I don't like this. Like when you go over a funny hill in the car and you're like, I don't like that. And that's what's so genius about it, that like I woke up in the blistering sun the day after and I was like, I can't stop thinking about this film. Like I can't There's so much going on.
It's like being on a roller coaster or a really horrible funfair ride, but going really slowly.
Oh my God. It's like the Willy Wonka boat tunnel.
Yeah.
Films.
But and you know it's going to turn upside down at some point, and you're just like, I don't know how or when. It's just happened so slowly, and suddenly you're wrapped up in this deep and awful thing. Yeah, it's incredible. Incredible filmmaking.
I don't know if you do want to see it.
I know you do. You do.
Really
just
do.
So that you can say you survived, because right. It feels like an ordeal. And when you come out
the
other end, you're just like, I've done that. Well done.
Yeah, I'm very intrigued. I love Hereditary. Really, really intrigued by this. And everything, all of the things you guys are saying is like, yeah, okay, I can't even process how that is. I have to experience this. Mm. And sort of chat around the film, the discourse is very much like there's lovers and haters, but everybody sort of is picking out things that it's notable for, things you have to see it for. And I think seeing it with an audience and seeing everybody's reaction 100%. Does sound like it will be quite an experience.
Watch with an audience, watch on a big screen. It really is a director of our age doing incredible things with the horror genre, and I fully endorse going to see this on a big screen with an audience.
Okay, sold. So those are still out in cinemas, and audiences can enjoy, or I don't know if that's the right word for Midsommar, but can experience them. Some new films coming up. The Dead Don't Die is a brand new film from Jim Jarmusch, who, I don't know, he must feels like it's his 50th film or something. Like, this guy really cranks them out. So this film premiered in Cannes. It opens the Cannes Film Festival. Quite unusual for it's a zombie movie, to open the Cannes Film Festival, but it is directed by, you know, a famous author, Jim Jarmusch. Now, this film is notable, I guess, because it's Jim Jarmusch doing a zombie film, which is usually seen as quite a low-rent sort of genre, but also this cast is, like, beyond A-list. Jim Jarmusch has a very long filmography, and he has worked with some of the biggest names in film. All of them are in this movie. It stars Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Chloe Savini, Tilda Swinton, Tom Waits, Selena Gomez, RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan, and much, much more. Like, it's insane, the cast of this film. So you want to see it just to see all of these great people together. It is, I guess if you know the director's work, it is sort of like the greatest hits. This is like his, the Beatles, the greatest hits of films. He's just pulling on all of these names he's worked with. And it's such a novelty to see them on screen together. Mm. It is a bit like, I guess, a Shaun of the Dead or something. It is a zombie comedy. It is not really a zombie film, but they're in it and they're doing things. But it's about other stuff. Because it's Jim Jarmusch, it's about loads of other stuff. And it's all a bit weird. Tonally, I think it is comparable to maybe like Twin Peaks. Small town. It's set in Centerville, USA. Very small town. There's a police force of three people: Bill Murray, Chloe Savini, and Adam Driver. And they're all there. There's like one police car, and Tom Waits is a man, a hermit living out in the woods, who's been accused of stealing chickens from Steve Buscemi. And on that sort of journey, that procedural, you get to meet a few people in the town, and the dead start to crawl out of the grave.
Okay.
And I guess there is a good zombie cameo here. We get to see Iggy Pop and Sarah Driver playing zombies. So they have
Iggy Pop.
Yeah,
okay,
they have like
I'm
one
sold.
Line where they get to they murmur coffee. But it's like that experience is pretty impressive, and probably less about the story for me, and just seeing all of these like proper A-list brilliant actors doing Jim Jarmusch's tribute to George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Mm.
Sarah, you were at the screening with me. How was it for you?
It swung really well. Like, the how it came off the first couple of 20 minutes. That's a lie. Probably 45 minutes. I was so sold on it. I loved all the meta jokes. I loved the comedy. The Adam Driver and Bill Murray together were really good. They had such good chemistry. I loved the zombies. And then it just went nosedived so quickly. It became really dull and boring. It shuffled along at this really slow pace. What it was trying to say about different things was so predictable, like, you know, we're on our phones too much, so therefore we're zombies. Kind of element to it. The meta joke started to become lazy because they weren't used in a really good way. They ruined some of the best characters by making it too wacky.
It sounds like you liked the human bits maybe more towards the beginning, when it was sort of small town life and these sort of quirky characters.
Yeah.
You know, like, just it was quite, there were sort of very low-key exchanges with amazing actors in like a coffee shop or a diner and stuff, which I quite liked.
I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoy, like, fourth wall breaking moments always get me. Like, I'm sold on those Like, you can feed them to me as much as possible. And the fact that it wasn't working for me by the end of the film, I was so angry and mad. I just think it wastes a lot of its time trying to say things that everyone has said before, and then doesn't really know how to do action that well. So it's very slow and dawdling, like the action
like
pieces. Whereas you compare it to something like you just said, like Shaun of the Dead, where it is fast-paced but still has like the human elements and the comedy moments and balances it quite well. I just felt here was very lacking.
Do you think... Are you a Jim Jarmusch fan, I wonder? Because this feels like very much like a Jim Jarmusch film in that it takes its time, it's not really about the plot.
Yeah.
But with this film, there's a lot of ideas in it. And the film almost doesn't really move, isn't dynamic enough to convey them successfully. It doesn't do them justice. Some things don't really go anywhere, which I thought was a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
But I sort of did enjoy... This is like a proper American indie film, which just happens to be a zombie film. And I sort of liked that. Like, it's a totally different take on a genre which we're very experienced in.
I mean, I like Jim Jarmusch. Like, I like some of his... Like, I love Dead Man, and I love The Only Lovers Left Alive. It's one of my favourite films. And I like what he does, but I just don't think it works here. I just think it's very... It's just too slow for me. I think maybe it's because I have such love for Shaun of the Dead, and I was kind of expecting that kind of romp and raucous behaviour.
But the marketing is definitely like, it sort of feels like it's alluding to the Shaun of the Dead and also the like Zombieland style, you know, zombie comedy stuff. The greatest cast ever disassembled is the tagline, which is true. Like, the cast is insane.
But I get the impression that you loved it.
I didn't love it, but I really enjoyed being in its company, which I don't know if that's sort of damning with faint praise, but I enjoyed being in this world. I love films that are set in that sort of small town, that sort of like, you know, Americana kind of vibe. Really got huge Twin Peaks vibes from this, which I love, you know, like small town people dealing with really big issues and also like very mysterious and metaphysical, like in Twin Peaks. I thought it was kind of a bit of a romp, really. Not something that will stay with me. And I'd love that Jim Jarmusch has experimented with this. He's got it out of his system. But it's just something different from him. He's definitely not done anything like this before. And I think that might be why a lot of fans maybe, you know, aren't so sure about this one, even though it does feel like it's purely made for the fans, because there's so many nods to bits over his career. Like, it's all of the actors he's worked with, basically. Some of them several times.
Is it indulgent in that respect?
Indulgent in a low-key sort of way.
Right,
You know, but Sarah's right in terms of pacing. Like, it is like, I don't know if you've seen something like Broken Flowers or something, which is a very slow-moving Jim Jarmusch film starring Bill Murray. This is but with zombies and a larger sort of A-list cast.
Well, I'd be interested on that basis.
I think it's wholly unique, but I think that's, you know, it's sort of to its success and its detriment. It's just not for everybody, but it is. It feels like it is like the ultimate Jim Jarmusch film. Maybe it's like made for Jim Jarmusch, though.
Yeah, well,
it's like a Marmite film, I think.
Okay.
I think if you like it, then you're going to gobble it down, but if not, it's going to get stuck to the roof of your mouth and you're going to be angry that it's there forever.
I think there's a few things it introduces which it doesn't do justice to, and it might be that they get lost in the edit, or they just were improvised or something and they weren't supposed to be there. Like, there's early on, there's this song which plays throughout the film, The Dead Don't Die, and some people are aware of the song, and some people are aware that they're in a film and the song has just played over the opening credits. And I thought that was kind of a fun idea, Bill Murray saying, I think I've heard the song before, and Adam Driver's character going, yeah, it was the opening credits of the movie. And that's kind of fun. But then it didn't really go anywhere with that. And you're right, there's some fourth wall breaking stuff. Adam Driver has a Star Destroyer from Star Wars keychain, and Tilda Swinton acknowledges the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah.
It's maybe trying a bit too hard to sort of go, look, he's the guy from Star Wars.
I think I'm going to go and see it based on the cost. I mean, Adam Driver is a big sell for me, for sure. Chloe Sevigny,
I mean, he's not bad. Like, he's not... Like, there's no way he's less than excellent in this film.
Okay.
He really suits that the small town cop as well, I thought, actually, because he's like the hot cop on the police force.
Absolutely, and the way he says ghouls.
Ghouls. Oh yeah, that's fun.
Ghouls.
And he's not fussed at all. Like, everybody, there's some characters like are shocked, as you would be if zombies get out the ground and start attacking you. Adam Driver really takes this very calmly. He's like, yeah, zombies.
He does calm well, though. He does calm and collected quite well.
It's very fun.
He's just one of the most perfect actors. Sorry, that's like, that is gushing, right?
Yeah.
I'm not being hyperbolic.
But I think it's true.
Yeah, it's so true, because he can do so much with such little twinges of his facial expressions. You just know what he's saying.
And, sure.
Yeah. He's just so good. He's so good. I'm so excited to see, like, whatever comes next in his, like, no matter what it is, I'll be there to watch Adam Driver in a film. So I might watch it again. My friend said, let's go watch Adam Driver. I was like, okay.
It sounds worth a watch. It sounds quite fun. It's got Adam Driver.
I think it's very different, very unique. And I don't think it's for everybody, but I sort of think it's worth a go because it might be for you. I think people who enjoy this film will really, really enjoy it. But I do think the marketing may be a bit misleading. It's not Zombieland. It's not A Laugh a Minute. It's not Shaun of the Dead. It's Jim Jarmusch's day. It's a very American independent, you know, sort of mumblecore type zombie movie. It's not the big studio glossy thing. There is some action in it, not a lot of action. Adam Driver drives a very cute little car, sort of worth seeing it for that clown car that he drives around town. There's some sort of fun stuff in there. Cool, that's good. We have disagreed so much today, Sarah. How are we all feeling about a live action, I'm saying with quote marks, remake of The Lion King?
I feel like I'm going to be the negative person on this podcast.
Such a
like,
negative
I'm usually so excited about all the films. I don't think Lion King is the best of Disney's, like...
Don't finish that sentence.
Portfolio. I like it, but the storyline's very weak for me. I actually prefer Lion King 2 to Lion King 1. And now I'm going to stop because Karina's giving me a face.
Oh,
like,
my
what
God.
What is wrong with you?
You should totally
do you
tweet
want?
That out
there. What more do you want from a Disney? It's a lion cub and a monkey.
It's Hamlet with animals, okay? So it's good.
The songs
are great. Yes,
exactly.
I agree. The songs pushed them like by one little bit more, okay? So I'm not like, and maybe it's because I'm bitter about the Lion King game that I couldn't do when I was a kid, but...
Oh, it's all coming out now.
There's a reason, we see.
There's a reason. I could not get past the giraffes, guys. And therefore, it's damned in my head forever. I just... No. Yeah, so the Lion King for me, I'm not saying I don't enjoy it. I'm just saying that I think it's good in its little container here. And then to make it this grand sweeping live action... Photorealistic computer animation.
That's where I'm a little bit dubious. I'm not a big fan of live action reimaginings because I'm always there's something about it that doesn't quite look realistic enough for me. I think if you're going to be a cartoon, you're a cartoon, and my brain is fully on board with that being not real. But when it's trying to reenact, so like talking animals, I'm always a bit like, really? But stick Beyonce in the mix and I'm kind of sold.
For me, I'm more excited about Seth Rogen, but I'm not excited about having a crush on a warthog, so
there is that.
Do love me some Seth Rogen.
Well, I think the cartoon was seminal. It was one of my Disney films like growing up. It came out a couple of years before Toy Story. I love that. For me, it's like Aladdin, Lion King, Little Mermaid, sort of era, Beauty and the Beast. Those are my Disney films. So I'm really excited, a little bit worried about seeing it. But I was actually quite impressed with Aladdin, which came out only a few months ago. Again, I mean, I'm not a Guy Ritchie fan. He directed that film. And I was like, why do we need to have a live-action Aladdin? But they turned it into a proper full-blown musical. And now I'm sort of thinking, if they can turn Lion King into a big old summer musical, I'm sort of on. I love the songs. I love this cast who are going to be singing the songs again. Donald Glover, Beyonce, Seth Rogen, you know, all of these great famous singers.
And is it shot for shot?
No, because it's a lot longer. And we're seeing this. We're often seeing these sort of 80, 90-minute long Disney animated films now becoming... I mean, Dumbo is originally a 61-minute feature and they turned it into a 2 hours-plus live-action film earlier this year. So they are sort of adding bits to the story and they're changing some of the staging. But I think sort of plot-wise, it's kind of be beat for beat. And I think song-wise, I hope it's word for word, because why would you change any of the songs?
I know, they're perfect. But are there any new songs?
Yeah, apparently Elton John has written one or two new songs and Hans Zimmer has come back in. So it was a collaboration between Hans Zimmer and Elton John, and they've sort of come back together for this new version.
I'd kind of hope they did what the stage show does, is take the best song of the whole Lion King franchise, which is He Lives in You from Lion King 2, and put it at the beginning of the film, because He Lives in You is like phenomenal, and you see that on stage, and I'm kind of hoping for that, like then they maybe pull that in, because it is one of the best songs.
I think you're the only person in the world who's seen Lion King 2.
I adore Lion King 2.
You'd be lying for all I know.
Yeah, Lion King 2, guys. Simba's Pride. Go watch it now.
So that's our review of Lion King 2. 21 years too late. Available now on VHS. any local store.
This is the Pride Rock that I will die on. Okay.
Okay, well, I'm intrigued to see what you make of this Lion King remake. Sounds like there's a lot for it to live up to. Yeah. Let's talk about some things coming to a Picturehouse cinema near you in the very near future. First of all, we're doing our first surprise film across the Picturehouse cinema group ever. We've done the odd one. We do one at Sundance London, which has hosted at Picturehouse Central, which Sarah Cook is very, very familiar with. But... Mm. This new mystery film we're doing across the whole group, all 25 picture houses, is a film, and you don't know what it is, Sarah.
I don't know what it is. Is it Lion King 2?
It's Lion King 2, Simba Fry. How do you feel about surprise films?
I love surprise films. I mean, I don't, and I do at the same time. I'm kind of one of these, I feel like there's a confessional for me.
Let it all out.
Let it all out. I'm not a very, I quite like knowing the end of things before, I like spoilers, okay?
You're my spoiler person.
I'm like a girl that goes to the back of the book and reads the ending and then goes to the beginning. I like it.
Is that why if you die, you'll always know that the end before... You know,
exactly. It's good. I like knowing everything, okay? And I like sometimes not being surprised. But I like the journey, that you go on with loads of people. Like, I love that kind of...
The collective not knowing.
The collective not knowing is really fun. And the whispering.
Yeah.
It's definitely this.
I agree. There is a real collective unity. And I love the fact that most surprise screenings that I've been... Yeah, in fact, all the surprise screenings that I've been to, either at Sundance or London Film Festival, they've all been sold out. Mm. And you sit there, and that collective anticipation and the guesswork and just knowing before the screen even goes up that you're basically among the biggest film fans in the city at that point because they've all gone out of their way to buy a ticket. They don't even know or... quite frankly care at that point what the film is, but they know that from the time that they've got that seat there's a whole guesswork game and people are talking about it on Twitter.
Because it could be anything before the film starts. It could be anything,
yeah, but they are willing to put that money on that seat and be like, right, I give trust to this film festival or this brand that the film that they're going to pick is going to be a good one, because it's normally a preview as well. It's always something that you're going to be the first to watch it. And I remember going to see so I've been to the London Film Festival one a couple of times, and the Greta Gerwig came on and did an intro, and then we all knew it was going to be Lady Bird, and everyone was just so elated. Everyone was like, yes, we're all going to see Lady Bird together for the first time. This is going to be great. And then Greta Gerwig, we all gave her a big cheer, and it was so special and so lovely. Mm. It's also interesting to see the biggest film fans, geeks as well. So I've been in surprise films and they know straight away as soon as the distributor card comes up. And I see people righteously storm off because they know it's going to be a film because it is a film that this distributor did, they're like, no, it can't be the film that I thought, and just stormed out. And that's the funny part. If you're sitting quite at the back, you can see the few people that are like, no, sod this. I'm like, oh, come on, guys.
When I worked as an usher in a place that did secret screenings, it was always fun for me to... People do have convinced themselves it's going to be something it isn't.
Yeah.
So they go in, it's like, it's definitely going to be this. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. Well, one time it was in the Heart of the Sea was a surprise screening. And this woman had taken her kids and she was like, it's definitely going to be Star Wars. I'm like, there is no way they're showing The Force Awakens.
Surprise.
No, it's quite fun. People do often have high hopes. It's like, no, they're still making that film. That film isn't finished yet. That film doesn't exist.
What are you talking about?
But this is taking place on the 2nd of August. It will be a preview. We can confirm that. Sarah, what would you like it to be?
2nd of August.
Star Wars.
It's definitely going to be Star Wars. I mean, obviously 2nd of August, probably my hopes, my big hope would be Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm. But I don't think it would be. And obviously there's Blinded by the Light. Oh God, there's so much good stuff coming out in August. I don't know.
Okay. Toy Story 5?
The Lion King 2. The Lion King 5.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, keep guessing because so we've got a couple of weeks before it takes place. But I'm excited by this. I hope people come and enjoy. And it'll definitely be a preview, so hopefully something no one's seen before. Mm. And yeah, hopefully people enjoy the experience. And maybe we'll make it a regular thing.
Yeah. I fully endorse the idea because you'll just all come together and you'll have those claps and cheers and that that instant of coming out of the cinema and just talking to everyone, and you just shared that really fun experience, and you're all in on the knowledge. It's great.
And it's so pure, because you don't have any preconceptions of what film you're going to watch. Mm. So it could be something that completely blows your mind.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. I sort of love that, because even if you haven't seen a film before, you've often seen a trailer or a poster or maybe read a review, and you're like, oh yeah, I hear this bit's good. Yeah. I hear this. I like that actor. And then watching this, you're like, I don't know. I don't know what to expect. Yeah. So I usually really enjoy surprise films. I always go as a sort of a point to the London Film Festival once every year, and it's like the one ticket I buy straight away. Like when members priority booking, I'm going to just buy that, and I'll think about the rest of the program later. As long as I got my surprise film ticket, I will be happy. And I love it. You watch films in a totally different way, and it's hard to get to do that, especially when you're working in film marketing. You see a lot of stuff, so it's sort of like trying to make this a bit more of a regular thing.
Nothing swaying your opinion, and it's such a luxury to not have to make a decision sometimes as well. Yeah. It's just I'm going to go to a surprise screening, and whatever it is, I'm going to sit there for 2 hours and be entertained.
I'm going to put my trust in my local cinema and hopefully they pick something good. And I really hope we pick something good. But I'm looking forward to doing it. 2nd of August. And we'll see you there. Mm. So you mentioned Tarantino, Sarah, which is good because he has a new film out, as you mentioned, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We've not seen it yet. We'll talk about it on a future pod. But in the lead up to that, we are screening some of Tarantino's greatest hits. We've already had, at time of recording, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. Very exciting. Coming up, we've got Jackie Brown, Kill Bill, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained. How do we feel about Tarantino? Which one of those films are you looking forward to seeing the most, Sarah?
With the exception of a certain film that came out like a couple of years ago, I am an unapologetic Quentin Tarantino fan. I have loved every single one of his films, and I am excited to watch Django Unchained because it's the one I watched 5 times in the cinema when it first came out.
So Toy Story 4. But how about you, Karina? Where do you stand on Tarantino?
I think he's an incredible director, and he's really boundary pushing always, and he's consistent. So he's always consistent. He's got his gang of, quite frankly, the best Hollywood actors always. Like, you know, from Leonardo DiCaprio and Jamie Foxx and Samuel Jackson. They're just always there, and he must be doing something right because they keep coming back. Just to have that heady mix of violence and dialogue and music. The music is the biggest draw for me, I think. The soundtracks, you always just come out toe-tapping, even though you've just wiping the sweat from your brow because everything's just been so rambunctious. And you always know that you're going to be in for quite a breathless time, which I quite enjoy. It's an experience. So he's always providing experience. He's not just creating films. But also to what you're saying, Sarah, he's also got commentary going on as well. So I like the fact that he's so divisive, and you can really pick apart his trajectory of films and him as a person, and, you know, man separated from art, all that always comes into play every time a film of his comes out. And I enjoy directors that do that.
And then finally, we've got a few more previews in our Discover Tuesday strand. I guess most excitingly, Animals, a film that we've been lucky enough to work on. And it premiered at the Sundance London Film Festival, and the cast and director came over. Very exciting. Karina, when can people see Animals?
They can see it in cinemas nationwide from the 2nd of August. So we're very excited.
And when's it coming to Discover Tuesdays?
It's coming to Discover Tuesdays on the 30th of July.
Nice. Okay. Yes. Be ahead of the game.
Yep. I can't wait for everybody to see it. Make sure that you've got a drink in your hand, because you'll definitely want to have a large glass of white wine or a tequila shot. It really is a special film, and it's a very genuine portrayal of womanhood. Two best friends as they trip over from their 20s into their 30s. But it's a really observed telling of how women suddenly have to find themselves at a point in their life where they decide whether they're going to maintain this hedonistic lifestyle or start getting real about what they want from life. And Emma Jane Unsworth is the writer, and she has adapted her own book for the screen, which is quite rare.
Incredible. Yeah, no, I had a really good time seeing it at the Sundance London Film Festival. Sarah, did you see this film?
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm on board for it already.
Nice.
Because those two actresses are... I love them. And that's all you need to
They
know.
Work very well together enough. As well.
Yeah, no, it's I'm such a big Arrested Development fan. It was so nice to see Alia Shawkat maybe in this film in Ireland. You're getting drunk with Holiday Granger. Had a great time.
Yes. Yeah.
That brings us to the end of another Picture House pod. If you've enjoyed our voices, we actually all do other podcasts. We're on other podcasts. Sarah, where can people hear your voice?
You can hear me on Your Films Are Numbered, and that's at Numbered Films. And it's the sinister sounding podcast with a Sesame Street type theme where we're going from zero to a million counting up with film titles.
Fantastic. I will definitely listen. That sounds incredible. Karina, where can we hear your voice?
You can also hear us on the Who Is She podcast, which is a Bechdel Test Fest podcast. Bechdel Test Fest is a outfit that I co-run and founded many years ago. And yes, Who Is She basically talks about the life and times and trajectory of a very important woman in film and how she's changed the landscape for the cinema for the better.
And who's the current subject?
The current subject is Regina Hall, who is the lead lady in Support the Girls, which is out in the cinemas at the moment, and is coming up as a Discover Tuesday at Pitch House Cinemas. And we talk about Regina Hall's early work right up to Support the Girls, which has won her lots more accolades and lots more attention, well-deserved. And we also talk about women in comedy and the power in that on film.
That sounds fascinating. I loved Support the Girls, saw it twice this year.
Best film
One
of
less
the
time
year.
Than
it's
Toy Story 4.
Yeah. Yes.
And when I'm not doing this podcast, you can hear me on the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, which is a podcast about films under 90 minutes. Something close to my heart. So thank you both for joining me, and thank you listeners for listening. And a huge thank you to Silk Factory, which is where we're recording this. A very, very lovely recording studio, which I love using. Proud supporters of the Picture House podcast. Silk Factory are an awesome film marketing and creative agency, making some of the coolest trailers and creative content out there across TV, digital and social. Please follow them on Twitter because they tweet these amazing GIFs, which I always talk about, but I really love seeing them. They're doing really fantastic work in that field. So you can check their work out at thesilkfactory.co and follow them on social media. And yeah, if you've enjoyed the podcast, please rate on Apple, iTunes. It really helps. And subscribe for future episodes. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, maybe talking about the Tarantino. Very exciting.
Woo!
Woo! Woo!
Cool.
More enthusiasm. Woo! Woo!
Yeah! Maybe I enjoyed Lion King. 'm gonna do this now, and it's like deception, disgrace, evil, and it's like they're going betrayal, and it's just so dramatic and it's beautiful, and I mean